Welcome back. We're talking to Pacific University Professor Jules Boykoff, who has just returned from the UN Conference on Climate Change held in Nairobi. Jules, thank you for joining the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Maybe we can begin just by talking about what you were doing in Nairobi.
Sure. Well, I was there for the United Nations Climate Change Conference, and I was part of a panel that was titled Communicating Climate Change. And the panel was sponsored by a nonprofit organization from Norway that does climate science research. And there are a number of panelists, each got 10 minutes to say what he or she had to say, and then we opened it up for a discussion with a larger group who had assembled.
So I know just from the media reports I saw for that panel that Mark Moreno, who is the Director of Communications for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee in the States, which is chaired by Senator Inhofe, I believe?
Yeah, Senator Inhofe, right.
Inhofe. So he was really critical of the conference in general as just being what he called an echo chamber, I believe.
That's right.
And he basically, maybe you can explain his position.
Sure. Well, let me give a little background about who else was on the panel, then
I'll
be happy to talk about him.
Right.
Basically, the panelists included a scientist by the name of Rajendra Pachauri. And he is the head honcho, that's not his official title, but he's the head honcho of the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is sponsored by the United Nations. So top flight scientist. Also Paul Prestrud, who has done a lot of great work on the Arctic, and a lot of his research, he's also a climate scientist. He's Norwegian, and he was also on the panel. Then there was myself, and you mentioned Mr. Morano, and finally there was a human geographer named Lisa Antila, who was also participating. She does also media coverage research on global warming and climate change more generally. So this Morano gentleman, mm-hmm. who you mentioned, who I might also just point out, before he joined Inhofe at the Environment and Public Works Committee, he worked for Rush Limbaugh as a writer and producer, which is kind of interesting, I think. In any case, he basically was at the conference with a number of other people that I presume are either from Inhofe's office or the Environment and Public Works Committee, who are basically just going to a lot of these panels and asking basic questions and about the climate science and trying to really refute it. And so his participation on the panel was sort of an extension of this effort to sort of cast doubt or at least annoy people as he went around the conference. So at the actual event, he was pretty obstreperous. He was pretty harsh. He was making personal attacks against various people, including myself, including Dr. Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, and really just questioning the science, saying that the science isn't good enough, that we shouldn't really believe that we actually do have global warming and that it's not just natural variation in the climate. So I think the audience, which was largely international audience, was essentially stunned at him because it's just sort of a done question in the rest of the world. Yes, we have global warming, and yes, humans are contributing in a major way to it. So I think he kind of took everyone by surprise at the conference. That said, the people in the question-answer session totally engaged him and challenged him and asked him to sort of rethink what he was saying. Of course, he didn't rethink it at all. He just was tougher in what he was saying. But, you know, my point during the panel discussion was, look, good people of the international realm, you're getting a nice dose of what we deal with all the time in the United States, where a handful of skeptics who really don't have any climate scientists supporting them who are working in the peer-reviewed journals, they get to sort of steal the stage and take us away from what we were supposed to be talking about, which was how media coverage could improve, how the scientists, policymakers, and media workers could talk in a more productive way together. The shift was made away from that, thanks to Mr. Morano's commentary, and toward basic questions of whether climate change is happening or whether global warming is happening.
So why is the media coverage the way it is and gives, because also in Canada we have a fairly small group of very vocal skeptics, and they also get a lot of media coverage. Why is it, do you think, that these people are able to get their voice out so prominently in the media despite the scientific support?
Well, I think there are a number of factors at work there. And first of all, in the research that my brother, Maxwell Boykoff, who I do all this research on media coverage of global warming with, Max and I talk a lot about balance being a key dimension to how this happens. Because after all, good journalism, so to speak, is based on the pillar of balance. that's considered to be one of the most important parts of journalism. So in a sense, then, journalists who are giving these people their due are just adhering to the norm of balanced reporting. So there's that. There's also a couple other factors, I think, that in terms of what journalists are thinking when they make news. And one of them is that another norm of journalism called personalization. And what I mean by that is you make the story into a personal story, focusing on the triumphs and trials and tribulations and quibbles and etc. of individual personalities, and really focusing on who they are as individuals. And this has certainly been the case in the U.S. coverage of these climate change skeptics, in our version of what you have up there too. And then also the notion of dramatization, a third important journalistic norm. When you're out there sniffing for a story and you're a journalist, you look for controversial, dramatic episodes, preferably involving these personalities with their triumphs and quibbles and all that. And so these are three of the major dimensions about what determines news: personalization, dramatization, and balance. When they combine together, oftentimes it makes for engaging news. But we're basically saying that with global warming, it creates a problem. Because when you engage in balanced reporting on the issue of whether humans are causing global warming, you're in fact engaging in a form of bias, informational bias, or informational distortion.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting because there's been, you know, the occasional piece of information that comes out that really challenges the skeptics in Canadian media, and it's normally based on trying to expose their, you know, conflict of interest, their funders, some of their personal backgrounds, but it's rarely do I ever see any kind of structured analysis of the media and how it's really has an internal bias built into it, especially for science reporting. Mm-hmm. And so I know the objective of your panel was a discussion on how to portray climate change in the media. Was there any kind of consensus on how to work with the media or with editors or try and influence them to get over giving this coverage to the skeptics?
Well, regrettably, we didn't get to talk about that in as much detail as we had planned based on what I was talking before about with Mark Morano sort of stealing the show, kind of hijacking the panel. But there was some interesting ideas that were put forward, and one of them by Paul Prestrud, the scientist I named from Norway, who was heavily involved in this big Arctic study that came out in the year 2000. And this study got a ton of media coverage, and he was talking about how they fashioned this and how they worked with the media. And quite frankly, I mean, it might sound a little crass, but the fact is that if scientists want to get their information out there to the media, they have to be a little bit more open to using PR, because that's basically what they did, making all these handouts and over, maybe not oversimplified, but highly simplified graphs and sort of bullet points of what the major findings in the study were. And scientists are doing this more and more, and they're hiring science writers to sort of translate their highly technical science language into a language that everyone can understand. So we heard a little bit about that from Paul Prestrud in terms of what they are trying to do, and I think that they can only get better at this, and that'll help them in a lot of ways.
Do you have another point there? Or?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I heard Chris Mooney, who's a journalist doing good work down here in the United States, who writes on issues of science. He's got a book called The Republican War on Science, and I saw him give a talk recently in Oregon, where I live, and he said scientists are not the problem, but they are not enough of the solution. And I agree with that, with what Chris Mooney's saying. I think scientists need to become more committed advocates for their work in the public sphere. A lot of them like to sort of sit in their laboratory. They sort of have this myth, this sort of dichotomous myth of the pure apolitical laboratory versus this sort of idea of an impure, hyper-politicized policy arena. And I think they just need to kind of get over that, because the other side that's trying to refute and actually doing a pretty good job refuting their scientific findings are embracing the hyper-politicized policy arena. It's about time, I think, the scientists need to do it too. As unsavory as it might sound, I think they need to do that.
I was wondering if you knew of if the media kind of landscape or debate in Europe or elsewhere in the world has, you know, the same amount of skeptics and just kind of the questioning of science, like the level that we do in North America.
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't done a systematic analysis of that, but I have talked to a lot of people in Europe, including when I was just at this UN conference in Nairobi, and many people from the audience came down and talked to me afterwards about, they were just astonished. They couldn't believe it. It just seemed like a truly foreign concept, which I guess it is to them. And basically, people from Belgium said we've already made this decision long ago. This might have been a debate we would have had like 15 years ago, but it's a done deal now. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't skeptics in different forms out there. One of the more famous skeptics is a fellow by the name of Bjorn Lomborg, who basically makes the argument that if global climate change is real and it's a threat, it seems like a waste of money to throw all our dough at that. Rather, we should take care of some of these other structural problems. So they have their own, and he's from Denmark, if I'm correct. So they have their own kind of brand of skeptics, but I haven't seen any kind of systematic analysis that judges whether they're getting over their due like they are, definitely in the United States, and it sounds like Canada, too.
Sure. I got a question I get about the conference, because it seems that climate change has become an increasingly popular issue, especially in Canada, but North America as well, I assume. but there seems to be a gap between what states are willing to commit to and what the public seems to be demanding in terms of real kind of concrete action based on consensus science. And I was wondering, since you were there, if you got what kind of impressions you got from how the negotiations were going, and because I know a lot of ENGOs and civil society groups were there too, and if that was kind of having an impact on kind of moving this forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the conference, I should say there's sort of two parallel worlds going on, and one is the one you're talking about right there with the official delegates negotiating over what was going to happen after Kyoto is done. And then in the other half is the side I've been describing, sort of other part of the parallel world there, was the NGOs that are, and also the states like Germany or Japan or the United States that put on these special panels. But in the delegate session, there was not as much progress made as most people had hoped would happen. And a lot of it has to do with this sort of obstructionist behavior of countries like the United States, of countries like Canada, actually,
sure.
And Australia and Saudi Arabia and other groups. In fact, there's an NGO there called the Climate Action Network. And every day, toward the end of the day, they had a special ceremony where they would give out the Fossil of the Day awards. And this was not a real positive award. They'd basically give it to the country that was trying to get in the way of these negotiations the most. And if you look at the Fossil of the Day award winners, it was consistently Canada.
Yeah, we were on top.
Yeah, you're number one.
I think, I did see that too, and I noticed the states only had three, and I think we had something like 17, or...
Yeah, you guys really hauled in the awards at this particular ceremony, the dubious honors, but...
Which is interesting, because a lot of the time the United States gets portrayed as the bad guy, which is unfortunate, because mm-hmm. especially in Canada we have this myth of us being, you know, this benevolent internationalists, unlike America, which is blatantly false.
Right.
But, maybe if you can just comment on what, as you described, is the other world and the environmental movement and what the feeling was there.
Well, I mean, there was great discouragement as to what was going on with the official delegates, for starters. And a lot of people are retooling their strategies here and thinking, we just maybe can't work through these huge bodies to gain this kind of action against global warming. And rather, we need to look toward more local communities controlling their emissions. I mean, in the United States, for example, California, under a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, just passed a law to control their emissions, and really pretty aggressive law that's unprecedented in terms of its scope and in terms of the fact that it's the state doing it. So a lot of people are retooling and saying, hey, it's not going to happen necessarily at the international level. We'll keep trying, but we also need to have alternative strategies at work here. And so I think you're going to probably see more and more of that as localities in the United States and perhaps Canada too take on the problem there on their own. There's a number of mayors across the United States who have signed on to agreeing to trying to get with the Kyoto standards, which is to say trying to drop emissions to 5% below the 1990 emissions rates by the year 2012. So I think you're going to see more and more of that, and also you're going to see more bilateral agreements between countries, and you're going to see more bilateral carbon trading going on, what some people call a cap and trade system. So, but the point is, not to get into the technical cap and trade stuff, but sure. The point is you're going to be seeing more between country, just two countries, maybe three, bilateral and trilateral negotiations to try to combat this because of the frustrations of trying to work it out at the international level.
Yeah, and those frustrations, like a lot of, especially the states that are that are really trying to delay action, like the Canada, obviously, and Australia and the United States, what kind of tactics are they using to slow down the environmental movement or just kind of marginalize it?
Well, I think for one, it's just this relentless attempt to cast doubt on the science. And this is what we focus on a lot. My brother, Maxwell Boykoff, and I focus on a lot in our research, and he's continued to do this. He's at the University of Oxford over in England and continuing this kind of media coverage on global warming up to the present day. So one thing is that we just, they're trying to sort of obfuscate or cloud the science. And like I said at the panel, you know, these people are not trying to win your mind. They're not trying to change your mind. They're just trying to cloud your mind. And that's actually a lot easier to do than winning someone's mind over and convincing them that you're right. You just have to wedge a little bit of doubt into their skull. And they've been very effective. The climate change skeptics have been very effective at doing that. And they have just a huge PR machine. I mean, I was mentioning PR, that scientists need to amp up their PR. Well, part of that is because there's a massive PR machine going on the other side. I mean, ExxonMobil, for instance, funds the climate change skeptics to a pretty great degree. And there's actually a really good website that you can look at that traces pretty carefully where Exxon gives its money and how that sort of makes its way to these climate change skeptics we're talking about. And if I can give the website, it's just it's just exxonsecrets.org. And you can trace these your favorite climate change skeptic and see where she or he is getting his or her money. So that's really how they're doing it, just throwing a lot of money at it and trying to cast out. They don't need to change your mind. They just need to cloud it.
Okay. Jules, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks a lot.